Backseat Producers, episode number 256, 12 Monkeys. Hey, this is Tony.
It is Daryl.
This is Tony.
We are the Backseat Producers.
And this is David. And this is David.
Or a clever belly. Or a clever imitation of him. Or an incredible simulation.
Come on, guys, that was dead on. You know it was.
Yeah. I'm Hispanic.
It's almost like David's here.
You're
right now
racist. I'm Hispanic.
Penis. By the way, I'm really disappointed. I had to I'm kinda
penis.
Glad it's unfortunate. Yeah, good call. It's exactly what he would say. I was going to bring David a cheese wedge as a consolation gift since the Packers lost.
I think
he's not here.
I think that's why he's not here.
I forgot. Because the Packers lost.
He claims that it's work. I think he's still so distraught.
Yeah.
Though he was very happy to see that the Seahawks lost.
Oh, really?
Well, isn't that the team that the Packers lost to early on?
Yes.
Because of the bad call?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he's lucky they lost, because the Seahawks, I think, I thought the Seahawks were going to steamroll everyone. They lost in the last minute by a field goal, so.
Nice little irony there.
Yeah. It's three of the four same teams are playing in the championship as last year. The only team that's not is the Super Bowl champion. They didn't make the playoffs this year, so it's interesting. We'll see what happens. So
next week, the next 3 days.
Right.
That is not
right.
Time travel or meant to be confusing. We are doing the movie.
We're doing it next week.
Called The Next 3 Days.
But the movie's called The Next 3 Days. That's correct.
And my Nexus is yelling at me.
It's chiming, actually.
I'm Tony. I've got a Nexus 7. I'm so cool.
Actually, it's an email from the intern.
I'm Tony. I have an intern.
Yes,
I'm so cool.
Yes, this podcast throws off
email.
Much cash. We can actually afford interns now.
So apparently, right now, as we speak, Backseat Book Club is interviewing TM Pip. I just got an email from Lena, the intern, and it reads, they listened to our review of Phoenix Rising. Okay,
uh-oh.
Back to the interview. I knew they did that actually because I pointed out to them T made mention that they got a kick out of it and actually referenced something that was said in the podcast because I've since listened to to their review of Phoenix Rising and they all thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, you and I have read Phoenix Rising.
Mm-hmm.
Go get it at your nearest ebook store or bookstore depending on how
yep.
you consume your media.
And if you enjoy it, they also have the Janus Affair.
Yes, that's the newest one.
So enough pimping other people's stuff.
We have nothing of our own.
Let's start prostituting our own stuff.
Not yet.
And it's not Sausage Fest season, so
that's right.
You're spared that. Oh, except I just mentioned it.
That's true. Although we were pimping the fact that you have a Nexus 7.
That's true, and it's
with a
lovely.
Cool little stand and key matching keyboard.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
So, like we said, next week the movie is entitled "The Next 3 Days." Russell Crowe is in this. And he doesn't have to sing, which is blessedly so if you've seen Les Miserables.
Now, I heard, did that win Best Picture at the Golden Globes or whatever?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's disappointing. Because that story is terrible.
Well, he's the same director with The King's Speech or whatever. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, ah, oh, whatever.
And, you know, watching the movie, Crow sings.
Well, he does have his own rock band. You know that, right?
No.
30-odd foot of grunt.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
That's right. I do remember that now.
Yeah. Now, I've never heard him.
Yeah.
But
he is... So when he's singing in conjunction with Jackman, they actually have a couple songs where they're singing counterpoint to each other.
Wow.
Man, it's rough. Because Jackman is Wolverine. He is the Wolverine of singing.
Yeah, but I thought he had like a lot of theater background.
He does. He's awesome. His Jackman singing.
Oh, see, when you say the Wolverine of singing, you mean like he's like
he's the
really
best
good.
He is at what he does.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So.
I think, man, like he sounded like Wolverine. When
no,
he was singing.
No.
Okay.
No, he actually, he's really good. So there's a point about three quarters of the way through the movie where Russell Crowe has.
Punches him in the face.
A song, because he's better. I don't care about you, Wolverine. I'm going to punch you in the face with my gladiator fist.
That would have been worth seeing.
That would actually be pretty cool. He sings he has a song unto himself, and it's not bad. When he is singing directly opposite of Hugh Jackman, it's rough. Oh, man, that's rough.
I got to say, though, I give the actors who put themselves out there to sing, like, for real.
Yeah.
All the credit in the world. Because I'll tell you what, man.
But, man, Amanda Seyfried, that Cosette is such a lame person in the story anyway. But, Jesus, they could at least pick somebody who had some vocal chops.
She didn't have any vocal chops. My God,
it was painful to listen to. Like, really, really painful to listen to.
Well, Tony, let me put it this way. Have you seen the Big Fat Greek, or not the Big Fat Greek Wedding? What's the one where they're in Greece? And it's the album.
Oh, Mamma Mia.
Okay. Have you seen Pierce Brosnan singing? Well, then you know.
Talk about train wreck. That movie was an all around train wreck. That was bad.
But my mother loves it.
Terrible. Terrible. Terrible story. I kind of appreciate the music of ABBA. I'm not gonna
I love the music of ABBA.
They make good music. That is a bad movie. That is a bad... The way they pieced it together, the story is terrible.
Went with my mother to see the version at the Fox and then watched the movie with her. That's right.
Julie and I saw the version at the Fox. The best part of going to the Fox to see it was after it was over, and then they just did that medley of ABBA songs for like 20 minutes.
Well, they do that in the movie, actually.
I know.
It's pretty crazy.
But they
my mom was
sing.
Like a huge disco person, so, you know.
I hate it.
It has its place. You hate it up. I kind of feel for you. I mean, I agree with you in a way.
If I hear Dancing Queen one more time.
All right. So today we're talking about 12 Monkeys.
Right.
The 12 Monkeys that raped Adam's ear. That is the reason he's not here.
That's right.
That's the story we created last week that we are sticking to this week.
Correct.
Daryl, what'd you think?
Oh, boy. Having seen this movie originally in the theaters and again after a long hiatus, I want to like it. It's a great story, but God, the pacing of this thing is just like a glacier. It's not one of my favorite Terry Gilliam movies. I mean, I can see a lot of things he was trying to do, and I'm just not really happy with it.
That's fair. What do you think?
When I was 19, I saw the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was cool. It had Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, and I saw it on video. I didn't see it in theaters. And I was like, wow, this movie's really cool. You know, and that's how I remember it. I watched it again, and I actually think it's a lot better than I ever gave it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's probably one of the best science fiction movies I've ever seen. I mean, it like in terms of like 2001, Blade Runner, that category, I would put it up there. I think it's really good. And after I watched it, I felt like, oh man, I wish I owned this movie. I wish I could see it again. I don't want to take it back to the store. I want to see it again. And that's how I felt watching it again.
I was torn when I finished watching the movie. And the more I stepped back from it, the more I enjoyed it. Because I was kind of disappointed in the ending. Because I was expecting something more to happen. I was expecting there to be something that broke time. And the more I think about it, I'm so glad it didn't happen. I'm glad that it happened the way it happened. Because for me, this is one of the really great examples of good, hard time travel sci-fi.
Yeah.
It doesn't break its rules ever.
No.
And even the times it looks like it's going to break it, it looks like it did break its rules, it actually explains its way out of the rules that it just looked like it broke.
Well,
and the more I think about it, the better I think it is. And I really, really do like it.
Well, one thing I did notice on a second watching here, a couple things I had missed the first time around, is the very ending when the guy gets on the plane and he sits down next to the woman Mm-hmm. And she says, oh, I'm in insurance. Okay, I knew that he said, okay, I just suddenly hit me. Okay, she's there to pick him up to get the virus. Mm-hmm. She was the backup. And I never got that, I never got what she meant by that. Until you realize that she's
that
one of the
scientists. I did not get out of the ending. Mm-hmm.
I got that out of it that, okay.
Now that's a very interesting
because the only thing they were
concept.
Going. Well, the only things that she was there for was, or what they're trying to do is get a undiluted sample of the virus. She's being the insurance. She's the last person who's going to catch this, who's going to catch up with him and get a sample of this virus by being exposed to it.
Now,
so when she snaps, Back to the Future, she's got the virus captured in her system.
And I wonder if.
Because
well, that's just extremely interesting.
All through the movie.
But it makes sense when you're explaining.
They're all through the movie. They keep asking him to pick up samples along the way. That's why he eats the spider. Okay, he's thinking, okay, I'll get something that has the virus in it, and they can synthesize it out of it. But
that really
he
is,
always
that
fails.
Really
at
is
that.
Quite brilliant.
And really, they never wanted to stop it. Mm-hmm. That was
never
their goal.
Intention.
That was never the goal
because
of the project.
Because it's already happened.
Because it's already happened. And
right.
Time is fixed, and that was what was brilliant about it.
And that's really the first, because if you watch Lost, there's a bit about course correction, and you can't change time, and things correct themselves. This was the first, I think, mass market visual time travel story that really incorporated that theory of time travel. You
know? Well, arguably Terminator.
Well, I guess Terminator.
You can't stop it from happening, you can only delay it. You can't stop Judgment Day.
That's right.
You can only delay it.
That's right.
Judgment Day will happen.
Okay. You're right. So
that's one of the precepts of the later Terminator.
Oh, the second one, right?
Yeah.
The second one is the one that kind of sets the rules for all of the Terminators thereafter.
Right.
Because the first one's really a horror for which the science fiction is the underlying motivation.
Yeah, it's a horror slash what am I thinking? Disaster movie.
Yeah.
It's an unstoppable force coming after her. The interesting thing is Terminator and Aliens, the path that they followed with Terminator with James Cameron doing the second movie of each, doing the same thing, taking a horror franchise and turning it into an action movie.
Yeah.
And doing it very well both times.
Yeah.
So no, I really did like it. And like there was even a couple of points where it looked like they broke that they changed something, but they didn't. They never really did change anything at any point along the way.
And everything in the film, I remember this, like, not catching everything that happened the first time around, having watched it again. Everything really is important. You have to listen to
everything.
Almost every single line of dialogue, because it will pay off.
And it's not just the dialogue.
It's the visuals.
The visuals too.
Anything on screen is there for a reason. Anything that looks out of place is out of place for a reason.
Yeah. Well, there was a thing I read about Terry Gilliam committing for a whole day to get a hamster and a wheel to run on the side of the screen while Bruce Willis injected himself, I think, with some kind of inoculation or something. Mm-hmm. And it took a whole day. Like, they could have shot it in 5 minutes, but he had to have the hamster running in the wheel because it had some kind of metaphorical value to the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's the kind of meticulousness.
That you're on the wheel. You're on a path that you have no control over and you can't get off of.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, that was Bruce Willis's course through the movie. Not only Bruce Willis, but Jose also.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there were a number of time travelers. You know, this wasn't a movie about a single time traveler.
Right.
There was at least four that you see at least a couple of times. Because it was Jose, the guy that kept calling him Bob.
Was that guy really a time traveler?
We don't
know. Was he? Or was that Bruce Willis' psychosis?
Right.
I think that's kind of the cool thing. Was that Jim Cole's psychosis?
Well, that's one of the great things that we're not talking about yet. And it's that I never believed that he wasn't traveling through time. But I think if I watched it for the first time as an older person, I would have seriously doubted whether he was traveling through. I would have thought, this is all in this guy's head for the
hour.
Probably bought into that.
I saw this movie probably like when it came out on video, like the first time. So I had forgotten huge chunks of this movie. And there's a point when you think maybe it is all in his head, and then they brush that all aside. There is a point in the movie when it can't be just in his head. Unless he is...
It's when she is convinced,
it's,
right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's when he says, they're going to find that kid in the barn. And even then, when they find the kid in the barn, he's like, he tries to actually talk himself out right. of the fact
well,
that he knew
that.
Well, that
guy could have seen the video that I saw and he had hidden in the barn.
Right.
What's so brilliant about... Here's another thing that I love about the movie. Unlike, well, Blade Runner has its own tone and everything, and 2001 is very removed. It's very, like, far away from you. Mm-hmm. You're kind of watching it from at arm's length. But 12 Monkeys is great because it's funny, and it knows it's funny,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't care. And I love that you find those situations, those vaudevillian situations, where he's trying to convince himself that he's just a regular guy and he's been insane the whole time, or when the scientists from the future are singing to him as he's yeah. in, like, the, you know, like...
It's very Terry Gilliam.
Yes,
it is
yes.
very
absurd.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, and it's great.
It's absurd.
It's not so serious.
But they also explain it. They also explain why the situation's happening. Where if you come into it in the middle, like when he wakes up and they're all singing, it's like, what sort of inanity is this? But the way they explain it, it's like, oh, we knew you liked music and we just wanted you to be comfortable when you woke
up.
And it's like
of the
yeah.
dialogue and everything is very. It's good. I mean. It's Monty Python in a mm-hmm. science fiction world, I guess, to some extent.
Well, it's a cockeyed world. Are we looking through James's experience, and he's been so screwed up for so long by all these time travels and all the things that have happened to him. He's having a hard time picking out which reality is real.
I love how when he comes back and he thinks he's gone nuts, he starts to pick up on some of Goyne's Brad Pitt's tics. He starts getting a little spastic, getting a little hand wavy and jerking his head around and flushing his shoulders. And he starts doing some of those things that Brad Pitt did to show how off he
animated
was.
He was.
Yeah.
Now, Brad Pitt was kind of the one actor in here that kind of is just totally off the wall. And apparently, they let him go quite a bit, though he did a lot of research on how to be this character.
I liked him in it. I thought he was...
Yes, he's the one you keep watching because he's so bouncing around all over the place.
Yeah,
you're never sure exactly where he's going to go, what he's going to do. After seeing him in this, I'm going to say I wouldn't mind seeing a Brad Pitt Joker.
Yeah, if he's capable of it anymore. I mean, I don't even know if it's in the cards.
I think he's capable of it.
You do?
I think he's capable of it.
He did a movie about Jesse James where he was really great. Other than that, recently, I didn't really think any of that spectacular.
Snatch was fantastic.
That was like 12 years ago,
man. It was a long time
ago. That was like when he did this movie.
I'm trying to think of something recently I've seen him in. Moneyball was good.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Moneyball's good. But he's playing a very sedate character in that. I mean, it's nothing like this at all.
Yeah. No, he's good. I guess I don't give him enough credit. He's good in this because he's very young.
Mm-hmm.
And to be young...
That lazy eye thing they gave him was crazy.
Yeah.
It was hard to watch his face. It really was.
It's, I think to be young and to play that kind of character, you have to be pretty good. I think it's easier the older you get. It's something someone was talking about Ben Affleck. I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Ben Affleck, when he was younger, didn't have the enough wrinkles in his face.
He didn't have the clout. He could always act, but nobody took him seriously.
Yeah. And so I think if you can pull something off like that when you're younger, it's more impressive than.
Well, this was early in his career, so he can afford to experiment a lot more.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. And it paid off though; he did a great job.
Oh yeah, he's one of the more memorable characters mm-hmm. against the rather sated Bruce Willis, who's usually a very dynamic actor.
Yes.
Who's playing these guys are playing opposite roles. You've got him. You've got.
You had him in Inglourious Bastards, Brad Pitt.
But in that movie, he's not really like his. I don't say his performance is like dynamic. It's just he's playing kind of a caricature of John Wayne. Essentially, mm-hmm. he's a John Wayne guy, and he's funny, but it's not.
Well, I'd say he's playing more like not John Wayne, but George C. Scott.
Yeah,
anti George C. Scott.
Now, to be fair, I'm going back and looking at Mr. Pitt's filmography. To say this was one of his early films is a bit of a misnomer. Because he did this after he did Seven, Legends of the Fall, Interview with the Vampire, True Romance, California.
He did this after he did Seven?
Yes. Both this and Seven were released in 95.
Well, Seven was just later than that.
Not according to IMDb.
Okay.
So, to be fair, he had a couple of pretty strong roles under his belt.
Yeah, but they were very different from this one. I mean, in Seven, he was the rookie cop.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still playing someone who's very, very grounded and stable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in 12 Monkeys, he's just completely out of control most of the time. And which is hard to do convincingly in...
Yes, exactly.
You can end up being a caricature, and everybody knows, okay, you're acting.
Yes, and you're right, exactly. So for him to do what he did... Like, his out-of-control character...
And make it convincing. Yes.
And it was a character. It wasn't just random.
Right.
It was very specific, to deliver all those lines
in all that physical action.
Yeah.
And to make it come out smoothly is not easy.
And it was a physical character, too.
Yes.
Because he did all kinds of tearing up and...
Bouncing around and jumping around.
Throwing people around.
Yeah, yeah.
Get out of my chair.
Yeah, this movie is... There's a lot to this movie. I want to see it again now that I've seen it a second time. I want to see it again. I feel like I haven't absorbed everything that's there.
Well, his rants are really good. I mean, you can record those and use those for all sorts of things.
His rants make me wonder why Fight Club was ever made. Because the whole... What Fight Club is all about, Brad Pitt covers in 10 minutes. Monkeys. And it's like, all right, you don't have to make that movie. Because they made it in a 12-minute spiel by Brad Pitt and 12 Monkeys. So, and that's all I got.
Well, one thing I'm going to throw in here, too, this was kind of a big risk for Terry Gilliam to direct this movie because he had had such a terrible track record up to this point of cost overruns.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to keep this movie on budget and on time and be a critical success and pretty much a financial one, too.
Yeah, I mean... Is it Gilliam's most successful movie?
I don't know if it's most successful, but it's one of his better... Well, actually, Brazil would be probably the one he's best known for.
Right. I guess I mean commercially. Well, I think Brazil lost a lot of money.
No, actually, Brazil did quite well. It was a movie he made afterward called Baron Munchausen,
which clobbered
him something terrible.
Okay.
Because of all the problems with that movie. And it was a huge critical... It was a critical and a commercial failure. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Although I think it's a very brilliant movie.
I've never seen it.
The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Yeah,
I've seen that.
I thought it was really fairly good. I mean, it's got some. It's a very Terry Gilliam
piece, right?
It's a very Terry Gilliam movie.
Okay.
Because it bounces around total absurdity. But if you know anything about Baron Munchausen, that it's a totally absurd story.
Okay.
The one I really know him for is Time Bandits.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that.
That was kind of in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, that's one you got to catch. I mean, that's probably his best, or one of his best.
He actually directed Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, too.
Yeah, yeah.
The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
I didn't see that one.
I did not either, but he did it. I'm just kind of bouncing around now to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, this puts the 12 Monkeys put him back on the list of directors that the studios can trust.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because... You never could trust him.
Well,
I mean, in the sense that
financially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm while you guys are talking, I'm looking up on Box Office Mojo to see what his financially successful films were, because the couple I bounced around at weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Time Bandits made $42 million. 12 Monkeys made $57 million. Time Bandits was released in 1981 though.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that tells you a lot right there. That he made, I mean, you start scaling some of those up, and that's... Yeah,
versus what they cost to make, yes.
For the adjusted prices, his number one movie is Time Bandits. Number two is 12 Monkeys. Number three is The Fisher King.
Mm-hmm.
Then Brothers Grimm, Brazil, Fear and Loathing, Munchausen, Parnassus, and Tideland. 12 Monkeys is the best worldwide, unadjusted, though. And that made $168 million worldwide.
Yeah, and again, the reason why Time Bandits did so well is because the budget was very low because it had no-name actors.
That's just
adjusted for inflation.
The box office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's become more of a cult hit, cult classic, too.
Yeah, I remember watching that a bajillion times on cable. Mm-hmm. We watched, I mean, anytime that was on, we watched it on cable.
And it's fun to watch, too.
Which one?
Time Bandits.
Yeah, I've never asked.
If ever a franchise is needed, a sequel or a redo, Time Bandits would be it.
Well, in a cursory search on Terry Gilliam, it sounded like they were working on a Time Bandits, too. But Gilliam's like 80 years old. So
is he that old?
That's the exciting part of the podcast where everybody searches for Terry Gilliam.
He's 72.
72? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's still got time for a few more movies. Yeah. He should do
a few more. He's a good director, man. I mean,
certainly has his own visual style. But being coming from an animation background, that's not it would not be terribly unusual.
I'm excited. The next movie he's making is called The Zero Theorem. It's to be released this year. A computer hacker's goal to discover the reason for human existence continually finds his work interrupted thanks to the management. This time they send a teenager and lusty love interest to distract him.
Damn those lusty love interests.
Christoph Waltz, Matt Damon, Tilda Swinton.
Pretty big name cast.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest names of the cast that I see, but that's a good start.
And due out this year?
It looks like it's due out at the very end of this year.
Okay, so it's in post-production probably now.
I'll make a comment just in general, but the music, the theme in the movie is so good. It's the accordion with the... with the strings in the background, and it sounds so insane. It sounds so bouncy and off. It's a really great theme.
Looking back through the dialogue, it's like you're watching this movie and you get really involved, and then you forget. There's some really great dialogue in this where she says, "Where are we going? Philadelphia. That's more than 100 miles. We can't. That's why I can't walk there."
Yeah. It's...
What's the matter with your leg? Got shot. Shot? Who shot you? I don't know. It was some kind of war. Never mind. You wouldn't believe me anyway.
And then that's when they pulled
the bullet out of
the bullet from the 1920s, and she had just talked about that in her.
She shows a slide of him being right
of Jose.
There.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, also of him too.
Yeah.
Because but she doesn't recognize it right away.
Right.
There's this naked man sitting there. Reaching over
now,
Jose.
Who cares what psychiatrists write on walls? You know what? There was a line I loved in this because it was a future throwback to the Sixth Sense. At one point, Bruce Willis says, "All I see are dead people."
Yeah, that's right.
I was like, "No, no way!" That line is going to be uttered by another character in a movie you're in 5 years from now.
I see dead people. Well, it's not him. He does that utters it.
I know I said another character in a movie you're in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. There are a lot of great dialogue scenes.
Well, and some of these are like some of the rants of Goines.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah. Sorry. I got a little agitated. I thought of Escape across my mind, and then suddenly, I felt like bending the fucking bars back and ripping the goddamn window frames and eating them. Yes, eating them. Leaping. Colonics for everyone. All right, you dumbasses. I'm a mental patient. I'm supposed to act out. Wait till you morons find out who I am. My father's going to be really upset. When my father gets upset, the ground shakes. My father is God. I worship my father. That whole sequence where he is jumping around, ripping at the bars.
Monkey business. Yeah.
It's.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Brad Pitt in this movie. He was, every time he was on the screen, he was what you should have been watching.
I mean, I agree. But I also enjoyed Bruce Willis playing against type. I enjoyed the whole thing. It was much better than I thought, than I remembered it was. The second time around. So
before we started recording, everybody's getting ready to go to bed. And Holden's like, "So what movie are you guys doing tonight?" And I said, 12 Monkeys. And at the same time as I say that, Julie said, "Some stupid movie." I said, "Wait a minute." And so I started talking about what it's about. And she's like, "Wait a minute. I think I'm thinking of the wrong movie."
What was she thinking of?
The Fifth Element.
The Fifth Element. Now I like that movie too. Actually.
Yes,
I do too. But that is very much not a Julie movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not a lot in common with 12 Monkeys. It has the same humor, maybe.
It has Bruce Willis.
Mm-hmm. and Bruce Willis.
That's the biggest common denominator between those two.
Yeah, it's a good point. And being Bruce Willis has numbers in the title.
Yeah.
That's true. So
there was this guy, and he was always requesting shows that had already played. Yes, no. You have to tell her before. He couldn't quite grasp that idea that the charge nurse couldn't make it be yesterday. She couldn't turn back time. Thank you, Einstein. Now, he was nuts. He was a fruitcake, Jim.
So let me ask you, I guess, just kind of to wrap it up and everything. With respect to the ending, you were saying that it was something you didn't want to see, but then when you saw it, you liked it?
Yeah, it was something that was very much not a Hollywood ending. The Hollywood ending would have been that he figured out a way to break time and get out of the loop that he was in and change things.
Right.
And there's even a point where it looks like he does that when he breaks away from her and makes the phone call.
Right.
But and so you're thinking, this is something new. This is something that didn't happen. And then Jose shows up and he's like, you know, we got your phone call. We got your voicemail. And he's like, the one I left 5 minutes ago? 5 minutes ago? 30 years ago? What does it matter? We got the message.
Right.
You know, we're here. We're here to fix the problem. You shouldn't have pulled your teeth out. That messed everything up.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that was great. Good. I thought it was great because at that point you think that he's fixed it. He's fixed time because now all his people are there. They're going to stop this. They're going to.
Something's
going to
happen.
Fix it, and the bad thing isn't going to happen. They were they never intended on it to happen. They never intended on it not happening. They were going to kill him to prevent him from screwing up time.
Okay,
that's why they handed him a gun.
Yeah, they handed him the gun. They handed him a gun in an airport. What the hell do you think is going to happen?
I didn't get that. What I got from it was they were trying to stop it.
No, they were
trying to stop it. They just replicate.
Yeah. No, because they didn't pull the Terminator. They can put people at different points in time, and they did. They on purpose put Bruce Willis with Goines in 1990.
Well, and they did say they had no intention of stopping it. They just were there to gather information of the path of the virus.
Right, because if you stop it, then nothing happens the way it happened, and the life that you know that you can't prevent.
Prototype.
You can't prevent anything.
Right.
All you can do is save the present.
Okay.
Collecting data, information, a sample from the past to bring it to the present to fix the present going forward.
Okay.
Not to change anything in the past because the past is fixed.
Right.
As they saw it, the past was fixed. And to manipulate that at all screws with their present.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Who's to say the present is going to be any better?
Or any worse.
Or any worse. Screwing with that may let everybody else live, and that means that the person who killed you lived and 4 days later shot you in the face.
Right.
You don't know.
It opens a Pandora's box, and they didn't want to do that.
So when he sits down next to the scientist in the plane.
Or they couldn't do it.
Well, it's the other thing, yeah. Everything they do, they've already tried to do.
Right.
Every time, and it just keeps happening.
Yeah.
So.
Time is fixed. Even the loops within
itself,
and that's the cool thing about this, and the cool thing about the way they use time travel in this, time is fixed, including the loops within time,
mm-hmm.
and the travelers through time.
It
already happened, and they have to happen to maintain
continuity.
The continuity of the time stream.
Yeah,
and I think that's a really cool discussion that they never have in the movie.
They never,
and
have
that is
it,
awesome that they don't.
It's everywhere because. Mm-hmm. It's in the hamster. I think they were saying, Terry Gilliam was saying that the monkey symbol is just going around.
It's circular. Yeah. It's,
and everything's about just
a loop, following a loop, following your path, following a circle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all there. But what's beautiful about it, and why I think it's such a good, hard sci-fi time travel movie is that they don't try to explain that to you. They just let you.
You have to
explain.
Figure it out.
You don't even have to figure it out. You just watch it happen. And if you accept the story as it happens.
Not everyone's going to figure that out.
Maybe not.
At least not if they see the film once. If they see the film more than once, probably.
Probably. But the way it's presented, a discriminating, intelligent viewer, I think, gets that. I think they figure it out. I like to believe they do. You know.
I think it took me 2 times to figure it out.
And that's, you know what, the first time you were 19, you weren't thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
I think the first time I saw it, I was, 95. I probably saw it in, 97. So I was 26. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as discriminating. I was looking for a cool movie, and
it was Terry Gilliam, Bruce Willis reputation.
Not even Gilliam. Mm-hmm. I was going more on the Brad Pitt, Bruce Willis reputation, and Bruce or Brad Pitt was crazy, and Bruce Willis was cool. And beyond that, it was like, I guess this is sci-fi. I don't see any laser guns, so yeah. I guess you're calling this sci-fi.
It's the problem is we're geared to watching sci-fi movies. We're geared to seeing a lot of special effects and tech. And we never think of terms of it's a mind game.
Yep. Yeah, and I loved it. Watching it this time, I loved it, and I appreciated it so much more than I did the first time I saw it. Because the first time I saw it, I was kind of cold on it. This time, man, the more I watched, the more I got into it. I was left a little cold with the ending because of my expectations of what a sci-fi movie should do at the end. True. Mostly from things like Looper, which throws you the curveball at the end to change up the ending, to change up the story, to give you the satisfaction of completion of the story that they're presenting. This didn't complete the story.
Right.
It presented everything to you and said, that is the story we're telling you.
Yep.
Deal with it. And so, like, immediately when the credits start rolling, I'm like, really? Is that your ending? But it let me stop and think about it and step away from it and enjoy that process of sitting back and thinking about the movie, which not a lot of them do anymore.
No, not really. I mean, the great science fiction movies do. They ask bigger questions than that and which exists in the
God
universe.
God damn it, I want Primer. I want that on Blu-ray, and it's not available. I want it.
Primer's pretty great.
Because I want to see it again. I've only seen it once, and I want to see it again because I know there's huge parts of it that I didn't really digest and didn't all click, and I want to experience it a couple more times. You know, I mean, that's why I'm thankful I've got Moon that I can go back to because I still have to watch that. I lent that to you, right?
No.
I did not?
Because it's Blu-ray and I don't have Blu-ray.
That's right.
So, just a couple other things I wanted to bring up real quick about the movie. One was, I felt there's some ways in which obviously the movie's story and everything aged very well. I think the story holds up and it holds up a lot better than I think we thought it would.
The best thing they did was set the story in the year that it came out. That the point in time when all technology freezes
is the year that
the movie comes out. Because 1996, when the catastrophe happens, is the year the movie comes out.
Yeah, and because it actually ended up being a lot more convincing now than it was then. When I'm kind of like, 1996, this just happened. Like, well, I think when I watched it, I was like, well, that was already 3 years ago. This, you know,
right.
So
they could avoid, I mean, the technology was absolutely current.
That's what they want to avoid is the anachronisms, and they did.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful job avoiding anachronism.
However, there's some things just that happened with the passage of time that I thought did not age well. One was the airports. The experience is complete opposite of what you would expect today. If you say that man has a virulent attack on his person, the whole place would shut down.
Yep.
Instead,
the whole place, everybody would be chasing after you.
Up against the guy who had the attack. Yes. Instead, they make Willis out to be some nut, which only 5 years later we all know. Now, you know, airline security is paramount. You know, any possibility.
But what's really cool is that is absolutely accurate for that time. Yes. And if they would have said the year he came back to 96 and the year that the virus attack happens to like 2004.
Yeah, that would have not been believable.
It would have completely broken the story.
You're exactly right.
5 years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I think really lends itself to doing that because then you don't have to deal with future events because every future event that happens after that within a week doesn't matter. Because a week later, everything is an alternate timeline because humanity has started dying.
And one of the other great things is you see the zoo animals halfway through the movie, and you go, "What the heck is going on?" And then you know why at the end, but you also know it has nothing to do with the attack, which is even better. Like there's just a lot. I mean, I probably could talk about the movie forever.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
There's so many things in it. It's so layered.
I love how they brought up the Cassandra complex.
Yep.
That was fantastic because, you know, anytime you have a character named Cassandra in fiction that has anything to do with time travel, you know, you pay the fuck attention to what that person's saying.
Right.
Because they are probably the one that knows what's going on.
Yeah.
If the writer has done their homework and doesn't want to just throw you a red herring, that's the person you listen to. And I loved how they threw that in and basically said, yeah, we know. You know, it's yeah. like you're not telling us something we don't already know. And, yeah. and I really dug that.
He was incredibly self-aware to the point where it didn't have to be self-serious like so many other science fiction mm-hmm. movies do.
That was really great. It was a good hard sci-fi story that wasn't snooty but yeah. oh, I'm so serious and yes. noble and elegant. No, yes. it was dirty and grungy and funny and wacky.
Average schmoes caught in a situation that they know they can't get out of, but are yeah. just trying to muscle bull their way through the best they can.
You went back to the 90s? Did you do drugs? Did you get lots of pussy? What?
Yeah.
What is
going on in a mental institution? What do you expect?
What is going on? Yeah, anytime he came to the future, it was like, I don't know. And I think it was just the way they shot it and the way they – because they did some really weird forced perspective things
on the future shots. Because he was up in this chair and they were all down there and they did a lot of weird like – almost like Lord it was of the really, Rings style, like Gandalf is huge, you're really small.
They did some really cool forced perspective things, made things very claustrophobic and uncomfortable. Yeah. The future always felt really uncomfortable. Like, this is, yes. I'm not supposed to be here.
Well, that's
and
how
I liked that. I liked that.
He wanted to be in the present, and ultimately, that's where his life ended.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he felt he belonged. And even that, you know, is something that...
And it's kind of a cool, metaphorical... meta statement that was when his life ended.
Yeah.
You know, as a boy, yeah. that was when his life ended also. You know, the life that he knew from that point on was not going to be the same.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool that the ending was actually that really slow, sedate, the kid and his family getting in their car and going home like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Like that, man, that was weird.
Yeah.
That was creepy.
And he watches the plane go on, which carries the virus.
Yeah.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
And it still is crazy to me that the logo, which is so prevalent in the movie, has nothing to do with the actual...
The 12 Monkeys?
Yeah. The 12 Monkeys has nothing to do with almost anything.
What?
Except for the meta story, the meta philosophy of the movie.
Right.
But it's really... I thought that was really interesting.
What I really liked also was how he was the time traveler. Bruce Willis, Jim Cole's character was the time traveler. And he's the one that normally you see the time traveler is the one that affects time, changes things, and sets the pieces up so that the future can take place the way it's going to take place or not take place. He didn't.
Yeah.
He influenced the people, and what he brought back from the future is what pushed people to do things that set all the puzzle pieces
yes.
up. It was never anything he directly did. He never acted on anything that had any effect on the future. Nothing he did. He influenced Goines to start the 12 Monkeys, to start the Monkeys. He influenced her by telling her about the Army of 12 Monkeys to leave the voicemail about the Army of the 12 Monkeys. When he tried to call the future, he was at the wrong time period, so he couldn't. So everything that he did, that where he was actively trying to
change anything,
he
yeah.
didn't change anything.
Yeah, you're right.
In fact,
you're right about that.
In trying to change anything, he actually
helped cause it.
Influenced the forces that caused it.
Yeah, I think that's. I thought that
and
was
that's
one
actually,
of the major points of the movie, yeah. and that's why I thought your point about how she said she was the insurance, that having a double meaning was so interesting to me because I thought
that was what was weird. I didn't catch that. That was her. I caught that she said she was the insurance. And I'm looking at her going, that's one of the chicks that yeah. was it. That was
yeah.
like
the
over him.
Scientists.
It's one of the scientists. What is she doing there? Why is she so? Why
I
does she look
it was
exactly
just
the same? Why
is it Gilliam absurdity?
Why
is
it, yeah. No. Why isn't she 30 years younger? And it was like, it didn't even
click, yes.
click that she was one set back until you mentioned it's like, oh, well, yeah, now
she
I feel like,
back.
Now
yeah.
I feel like a dumbass for not getting that.
Yeah. I thought it was her in the past and that she just happened to be there And
because Jose essentially watched what happened, knew that it was
and what's cool
that's
is
so brilliant.
And see,
he was able to recall, and they were able to set that up.
So
she is now.
Oh my god!
So just getting that and putting that together now for the first time, it actually fixes the problem of the non-ending that it had, because you think, well, nothing happened.
But that's not true.
But that's not true because they did it. They succeeded.
They succeeded.
Her going there and picking up the virus from him was success.
Yeah. That's so brilliant.
And there were actually a couple of
so great.
Yeah, there were actually a couple of cool red herrings that were kind of there that he came back with a cough. And I'm like, "Oh, is he the virus carrier?" Oh, because it was like he was coughing a lot. And the way I was watching the DVD player on my laptop, it threw up subtitles and I just didn't bother to turn them off.
So it was like cough, cough.
It was like cough, 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 cough. Every few minutes, cough, cough. It was like.
So that was by design. Oh, like, that's, you know.
Yeah. Oh, is he the carrier of the virus? Wink, wink. It's like, you know, it's going to be a red herring, but it was still, they kind of left that in there. There was that little thread that by sending him back, is he really the one that is the virus carrier? And for a few minutes, he could be. You know, he might be the one. So.
Yeah, awesome movie. I want to go watch it again.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. The more we talk about it, the more I like it.
Yeah.
Sorry you didn't, Daryl. Sucks for you.
Yeah. And you're the one who got more out of it than any of us. Yeah. We were both kind of like, that Brad Pitt guy's cool. And you, like, actually figured the movie out. And you're like, ah, it was okay.
Actually, the only thing I don't like about it is the slow pacing.
Yeah.
The pacing is slow, but honestly, I'm not going to fault it for the slow pacing. I think it actually kind of works. It works to tell the story.
All right. It's intentional. That's just the way this movie is.
Yep.
But it's just not what I like.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair.
If it's a personal taste. It's personal
taste. But I think this story succeeds because of its pacing. A faster paced, quicker cut movie, I don't think, gives you enough. Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be Terry Gilliam at that point. That's
right.
True.
It wouldn't be Terry Gilliam, and it wouldn't give you time to think, because this movie did give you a lot of time to process what's going on and to kind of suppose situations that were going to happen and to try to figure it out. And I think that it was wanting you to try to figure it out, because in trying to figure it out,
and even though the pacing
you fail.
There was a lot of frantic personalities.
Oh yeah, it's very character driven. It's a character driven story.
Yeah,
I think the slower pace made those frantic personalities
more
really
noticeable.
Yeah, it amplified their manic nature, especially Brad Pitt's. You know, his scene. You know, the whole scene with him in the institution was just crazy. His tics, his jumping around, his wild hand motions. And then when he starts slipping back into it after we see him, where it's like he seems to be this upstanding, normal guy, and then
very quickly,
he's not.
He's just saved by his father. That's all it was.
Yeah, and then you start, then you wonder, well, was he really crazy, or is this just side effects of all the drugs they pumped into him, or what?
I didn't even think about it. I just thought he was crazy.
He was mostly crazy.
Yes, his father says so in the end. He said, "I would not have believed this, but you really are crazy."
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder how he got there in the first place. He always talked about his father is going to be horrified when he sees that you're doing this to me and all this stuff. And his father probably put him there to begin with.
I thought they mentioned something, but I don't remember now. I'm peeking back through the dialogue to see if there was some mention of that.
I love the movie poster.
Yeah.
The movie poster is cool.
The movie poster, interestingly, makes reference to Terminator.
It does, actually.
It makes a reference to Terminator, and it's really interesting considering that Terminator is all about changing time, and this is about you are stuck in time.
Well,
deal with it.
I could be crazy, but it may have just been a marketing ploy to get people to see the movie.
And that's fine.
I mean, yeah. You know,
but it also served that other purpose. There's the television.
I mean,
it's all right there.
Terminator
all right there.
2 was a huge film, right? I remember it being a cultural phenomenon when I was 12. I didn't get to see it because I was too young.
You would be mine, but you're way out of line.
Huh? I don't remember that.
That was Guns N' Roses, when they released Use Your Illusions 1 and 2, their first single they released from it was You Could Be Mine, and it was released as part of the T2 soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
With your bitch slap rapping and your cocaine tongue, you get nothing done.
I just remember, there's some certain movies you remember being just like hovering over everything. And Terminator 2 was one of those movies.
Oh, yeah.
It was just everything.
That was a touchstone for that when it came out. It was just Yeah, the hype machine surrounded it, and it just...
It paid off.
Right, yeah. Right.
But...
Yeah, when hype machines don't pay off, you don't remember it as much, unless it's just that big of a train wreck.
Right.
But this one, it's like the hype machine for the first Batman movie, the first Burton Keaton Batman movie. Because I remember, like, in the days leading up to it, watching the 10 o'clock news, and they're like, yeah, so this movie's coming out on Friday. Will it live up to the hype? I mean, that was a story on the local news.
Yeah.
Because it was just the hype machine surrounding was just so huge. It was so big. I mean, you had Keaton and Burton and Nicholson, and it was like, Jesus. You know, Kim Basinger, you know, Prince at the height of his fame doing the soundtrack, yep. Danny Elfman scoring it. And it's like, I mean, everybody was involved in with this huge thing, and it was like, and there, I remember some of the talking head movie critics were like, yeah, this is gonna crash and burn. This is gonna fail on a scale like we've never seen before. And then it was just like, F that, man. They just steamrolled everything.
Probably for the Jack Nicholson.
I think that to a large degree.
Well, also being it was the first Batman that actually somebody played straight up.
Yeah.
Not as a parody. It was the first, not as a pulp
it
character.
It was the first superhero movie that looked somewhat believable in the universe that it was in. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was still a cartoon, gothic universe, but it worked.
Yeah,
I mean,
but it was, Tim Burton got a lot of the elements of The Dark Knight right.
Yeah,
he the did. First time.
Yes, he did.
He actually said, okay, this is a guy who actually read the friggin' comic book.
There'd be no Nolan trilogy mm-hmm. without that.
Yeah, so, and I've said that too, and I've had people like Adam, who's like, no, because you're only, you know, what you had was a progression of the Adam West Batman to the Burton Batman to the stumble of the Schumacher Batman to then the Batman the Animated Series, which just, I mean, everything that the Burton Batman movies did right, it just said, son, you sit down, we're going to take over from here. Mm-hmm. You know, and it built on
the Burton universe.
It did. Yeah. It built on the style.
Yeah.
And then it did...
What you call it, like the Art Deco...
The noir style, yeah. the clean lines, the gothic look to it. It just built on all that and just, man, it just slam dunked every episode, every story they told. Then you have The Mask of the Phantasm come out, and that's arguably still one of the best Batman movies that's ever been made.
At the time, it was your favorite one.
Yeah, it is one of my favorites. I can't say it's my favorite, but
anymore,
there's been a lot. There's been a lot that come out since then.
Yeah.
But man, yeah, it still beats The Dark Knight. I'm sorry, not The Dark Knight, but Batman Begins for me.
Yeah, I really like Batman Begins, but it was part James Bond.
It was.
And I liked that.
Batman's a ninja. Hey, guess what? Batman's a ninja.
Yeah, and Batman always was.
I liked all that stuff.
Batman was always a ninja. This is the first time they were really explicit about him being a ninja.
I didn't know that he was always a ninja.
Yeah.
I thought it was something Nolan did to explain his ability.
That's been something that has been a backstory for most of the modern Batman.
That's pretty sweet.
Easily since the late 70s. Yeah, some of the... Like the late 70s,
Before then, the comic books alluded to, he was just a champion athlete who perfected his physical conditioning to the absolute peak.
He traveled the world to learn martial arts styles.
Okay.
Right.
And it was like that vague, you know?
Interesting.
It was never terribly explicit. When they got into the 70s and 80s, they made it a lot more explicit that, okay, yeah. He studied under a ninjutsu master, whatnot.
Hmm.
What's funny is I'm gonna do another one of Goyne's rants. The ending of it is a little bit prophetic, considering we're 17 years away from when this movie was released. Mm-hmm. It was released in January '96, mm-hmm. so we're sitting here 17 years later. There's the television. It's all right there. All right there. Look, listen, kneel, pray. Commercials. We're not productive anymore. We don't make things anymore. It's all automated. What are we for then? We're consumers, Jim. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Buy a lot of stuff. You're a good citizen. If you don't buy a lot of stuff, if you don't, what are you then? I ask you, what? Mentally ill?
Yep.
Fact, Jim. Fact. If you don't buy things, toilet paper, new cars, computerized yo-yos, electronically operated sexual devices, stereo systems with brain implanted headphones, screwdrivers with miniature built-in radar devices, voice activated computers. It trails off from there.
Yeah.
And it's like,
you didn't do his inflections.
No, not all of them. I didn't get that crazy this time. It's a big block of text to read. I read it quickly, too.
That's in the first part. That's early.
That's
like one of his first speeches.
That's one of his first rants.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that would have been all true up until about 2008.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now we're in the new austerity, so yes, being poor is quite chic. Because we all are.
Yep.
Uh-huh. In the 18th century, no such thing, not a nothing. No one ever imagined such a thing, no sane person anyway. Ah, ha, ha, along with this doctor. Semmelweis, Semmelweis. Semmelweis comes along. He's trying to convince people, well, other doctors
germs,
mainly, that there's these teeny tiny invisible bad things called germs that get into your body and make you sick. Ah? He's trying to get doctors to wash their hands. What is this guy, crazy? Teeny tiny invisible? What do you call it? Germs? What? Now cut to the 20th century. Last week, as a matter of fact, before I got dragged to this hellhole, I go to order a burger. That's right. This is where he says what he did. I go to order a burger in a fast food joint. This guy drops it on the floor. Jimmy picks it up. He wipes it off. He hands it to me like it's all okay. What about germs, I say? He says, I don't believe in germs. Germs is just a plot they made up to sell you disinfectants and soaps. Now he's crazy, right? See?
Yeah, there's a lot in there, man. There's a lot to that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some ways, there's a lot of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in that movie, too. I mean, there's...
The sequence in the mental institution was very One Flew.
Yeah.
Very
One Flew. I mean, even the points that One Flew takes a whole movie to get through, which, as a product of his time, makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, you were just coming out of that phase where all of a sudden you were like, oh, you can't just lobotomize everybody. Maybe there's something to this. But... Yeah, I mean, the amount of psychological territory they cover in 12 Monkeys is pretty insane, too.
In what, really, 15 minutes of film?
Probably.
That sequence doesn't last that long.
No.
It's 15, what, maybe 20 minutes?
But, I mean, it's revisited every time Bruce Willis thinks he's insane. Every time you see Brad Pitt back on screen again. There's a lot, the Cassandra stuff, I mean, there's a lot in there. Throughout the whole film.
There's a lot that builds on that initial 15-minute chunk of the mental institution.
Yeah.
The whole story hinges on that.
Yeah.
It really does.
All right, that's all I got.
I got nothing else. All right, next week.
Next 3 days.
Next 3 days.
Peace.
See you later. See ya.